So regarding Dr. Greenfeld's class, I took the modernity seminar, and through the modernity seminar, I was exposed to sociology. And in the past, I have always been a strong ally of the biological sciences and the obtaining of hard empirical facts. But through Dr. Greenfeld's sociology class, I realized that it's more than empirical data collected from cell assays or, you know, certain types of measurements that one would accrue in the laboratory. It can actually be based on a logical framework. And through my presentation, I hope you guys can see that. And I've come to really appreciate your class. She sort of broke the dogma of thought that most scientists have, and now I've come to accept psychological disorders such as depression, schizophrenia, more as a social science rather than one that's hardcore biology. So, thank you. All right. First sentence. Writing about mental disorders without having experienced it is like writing about sex while still a virgin. That's my introduction. So, regarding that, I took a primary focus on post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, most of the psychologists and psychiatrists understand that post-traumatic stress disorder develops from, I have it right here, something traumatic that has happened to the soldier, or maybe a civilian who underwent a very traumatic event like an earthquake. The earthquake in Haiti would be an excellent example. 9/11, although epidemiological studies have shown that there was actually a below average of expected PTSD patients, which is really good for that. But usually PTSD has been affiliated with the armed services, and the development of PTSD, like I said, emerges from a traumatic event during which the participant engages in a life or death situation. And though we understand how the mental illness develops, how the mental illness, you know, sort of hatches from a seedling, there's no sort of mechanistic approach to how it actually develops, because there are certain combat veterans who perform very well after combat, and there are those who do develop PTSD symptoms. So in the focus of this paper, I want to sort of develop a mechanistic framework by which we can sort of develop from the point in time where the life or death event occurred, arrows, you know, through a mechanism to the development of PTSD. Okay. Right. And this this interest in this mental disorder actually developed from, one, you know, my personal interest as a future physician, and also from a book that I read. The title is War and the Soul by Dr. Edward Tick. I think he was a psychologist, yes, and he dealt with many PTSD combat veterans. In the book, he makes a convincing argument, but one that seems anachronistic and misplaced, relying heavily on mythology, superstition, and lore. And to me, that just doesn't really cut it, because, you know, superstition, what is that? That's a believed truth that doesn't have any backed evidence. So that wasn't really convincing for me. So I took a stab at it and said that the word soul has to be sort of manipulated or taken out of the argument entirely. Well, instead of taking it out entirely, I sort of reasoned my way through it, and I developed the argument that the soul, in what Dr. Tick sort of develops as his central viewpoint for the development of PTSD, and I redefine it as the mind or the consciousness, related to Dr. Greenfeld's current dealings in sociology. And to do that, I use the philosophy of John Locke and his reasoning in Essays Concerning a Human Understanding. concerning human understanding. And the Lockean theory, and I'll just read it from here. So this is a little excerpt. So for if the identity of the soul alone makes the same man, now this is Locke talking, and there be nothing in the nature of matter, why the same individual spirit may not be united to different bodies, it will be possible that those men living in distant ages and of different tempers may have been the same man, which way of speaking must be from a very strange use of the word man applied to the idea out of which body and shape are excluded. So from that, he's saying that the soul sort of exits and enters the body, which according to Dr. Tick, if the soul were to exit and enter into the body throughout many different bodies, then we can't really account for one person. And Locke, attacking this problem of personal identity, attributes personal identity to a thinking, intelligent being rather than the soul. And and then I go on to reason that if the soul were to incarnate from body to body, you know, it would have to reincarnate, and you know, I could be President Lincoln if all I, you know, cared in the past. So the word soul doesn't really work. And so to further Locke's argument, I develop personal identity through a forensic, as a forensic term. Well, I don't develop it, but Locke does. I just mention it. And personal identity is different in that it is a the person develops a forensic being within himself. So therefore, the person attributes responsibility for one's own actions. And from this, Locke states that it is the mind and the collective conscience of the individual that develops this personal identity. And hence, PTSD, rather than being developed from the soul, necessarily develops from the individual's mind and consciousness. So having defined that, I go on and state that, I try and frame the mechanistic development of PTSD from a certain event that was traumatic. So I start off with the DSM 4th edition definition, which is an event or events that involved actual or threatened death or serious injury, or a threat to the physical integrity of self or others. The person's response involved intense fear, helplessness, or horror. So that's the definition of that. And then I develop, so through the literature that I have accrued, there were a few common definitions. First was perceived self-efficacy, which refers to beliefs in one's capability to organize and execute the courses of actions required to produce given attainments. So in other words, a soldier in combat would have a firm grasp on the situation at hand. And then related to that would be a combat stress reaction. So you can think of this as an equilibrium problem, right? So, and let me give you the definition of the combat stress reaction. It refers to the acute stress reactions during or immediately after the traumatic event. So a person with high PSE, perceived self-efficacy, high perceived self-efficacy, there's through some causal attribution, and I'll get to that later, there will be a confident assertion of acknowledged agency, so responsibility attributed to the person and his or her identity. That leads to a clear vision of that person's identity to him or herself, and that leads to a healthy reaction. Now, if there is a poor response to this combat stress reaction, there is a low self-efficacy or a low belief or non-existent belief in one's capability to exercise, a controlled or control over a situation, and that through the mechanism, I'll get to causal attribution. There is some causal attribution disturbance. There's a low low sense of personal identity, and that leads to an unhealthy reaction or the development of PTSD. So causal attribution is the key, and it was found that in all of the literature accrued that the combat veterans with the highest ratings of PSE, this perceived self-efficacy, also took responsibility for their failures during their tour of duty. That, I thought, was really interesting. From the data that was presented in these papers, there was an inconsistency. The combat stress reaction casualties, so we're talking about later developed PTSD combat veterans, the CSR casualties attributed failure to uncontrollable factors outside themselves. However, low PSE means that the stress casualties doubt that they themselves will be able to function in a future situation. Shouldn't these individuals attribute future failures on controllable factors, i.e. themselves?
Can you just say that?
Sure.
Yeah.
So there was some inconsistency, and I'll just read it right through here because I thought it was perfectly worded when I wrote it down. So combat stress reaction casualties attribute failure to uncontrolled factors outside of themselves. However, low perceived self-efficacy means that the stress casualties doubt that they themselves will be able to function in a future situation. And then I posit the question, shouldn't these individuals attribute failure, future failures, on controllable factors, i.e. themselves? Do you want me to give you the definitions of PSE and CSR again?
No.
Okay.
I'm good, thank you.
Awesome. So, then I go on. This seemingly contradictory notion stems from personal identity. And I just mentioned that the relationship between this, the personal identity, and how it relates to sort of the forensic term, the forensic aspect of the person. And I'll just read it through here. The combat veterans who exhibited high PSE were also decorated and were deemed heroes, took responsibility for their actions, whether those actions were for triumph or for failure. Accepting the fact that one is a hero means that the person took responsibility for the action, or else there would be no hero, logically. Law of non-contradiction, I think, was the first philosophical example you presented in class, and I thought that was great. So veterans who exhibit low PSE fail to see themselves as agents, the causes of their actions during combat, hence charging responsibility, and this is the causal attribution, hence charging responsibility to objects other than themselves through causal attribution. So they may blame it on the weather, they may blame it on higher commanding officers, they may blame it on, I don't know, an untied shoelace or something, but they don't take hold of the situation personally, and they don't want to take responsibility of it. So through this process, because of a lack of agency, they lose touch with their personal identity, leading to combat stress and PTSD. So causal attribution is a very key sort of bridge in my mechanistic framework. Ooh, okay, how we doing? Wow.
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Was it established, do you have data, that low PSC leads to higher rate of post-traumatic stress syndrome?
I do, and I can give you the reference.
Oh, okay, great. I just wanted to know.
Oh, okay. Do you want the reference?
No, thank
okay.
you. That's very good. Mm-hmm.
All right. And I should make a note on that. Modern Army. I took Modern Army to mean Western, modern Western Army, not so much specific to the United States. The paper that I accrued, the paper, only one paper, was actually from a study of combat veterans from the Yom Kippur War of 1973 in Israel. So I took that as Western modern army. I'm not sure if that could be used as a demographic. I assume that it was part of the Western world, so I'm not sure how you're going to draw the line between Middle Eastern sociology, Western sociology. So that, I think, is...
So that was your one example?
One example, and then another actually came from... I cannot tell you, but it's Ginsburg et al. 2003, and I had to check the reference, the title, and how that was accrued, but all of these references were handed, or surveys handed out to combat veterans, mm-hmm. and they took the surveys, and that's how they...
And then they examined the perceived self-efficacy, or they knew perceived self-efficacy, and then discovered that people with low PSC had higher... Mm-hmm. Great.
So perceived self-efficacy was already pre-coined when this study was taking place. Uh-huh. So they already knew what perceived self-efficacy was. When they handed out the survey, they sort of posited questions to the combat veterans. And those questions, I guess through their own inferences, led them to believe that low perceived self-efficacy, maybe an example of a question would be when... you entered the combat zone, mm-hmm. were you confident in mm-hmm. your abilities to handle the situation? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then maybe another follow-up question was, after you re-entered friendly space, mm-hmm. friendly zones, mm-hmm. did you feel like you had a good handle on the situations that appeared to you that mm-hmm. were planned mm-hmm. and those that... were unplanned. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So sort of like a surprise attack or mm-hmm. an ambush mm-hmm. versus an actual planned patrol mm-hmm. and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. So by posing those questions and reviewing the answers, mm-hmm. that's how they sort of ranked the mm-hmm. perceived self-efficacy. Mm-hmm. Okay. Awesome. All right. Boy, I think I should speed up. So then, finally... I posit a hypothesis. I hypothesize that PTSD forms when one aspect on the pathway of causal attribution, so the pathway that I spilled out, much like how a faulty protein in a cell signaling pathway leads to cancer, so through a mechanistic pathway. A deeper holistic investigation of the individual soldier from different war eras, I go through that, and from these different examples from different war eras, I sort of support this mechanistic framework. I will not go through every single example, but I will highlight certain key points. Okay. So I start off with World War II, the Golden Generation, and I focus mainly on the social aspect of the war and one single individual who participated in the war. So I talk about how World War II was supported by much of the United States populace during its time because Pearl Harbor was attacked, and we sort of developed a notion that we were supposed to go to war because we were attacked, and this built a really strong societal link between... Well, I'll get to that later. Mm-hmm. So with the soldiers returning after the war, there were, you know, ticker tape parades. Everybody, you know, got a free lunch and stuff like that. Happy things happened. And this sort of boosted their own personal identity of the soldiers. This is what I posit. And society sort of buffered the reintegration of these combat veterans into society. And that was good. That was great. And even though this happened, some, you know, combat stress, as they termed it, PTSD was not coined as a mental mm-hmm. disorder at that time. They just termed it as, you know, combat stress or battle fatigue. Mm-hmm. It was at that time known that some of these combat veterans did suffer from that, but they did not coin it as PTSD. So that's great. I focused in on a specific individual because I thought he was a very great example of what we term PTSD in modern times, and he showed all the symptoms of it. So First Lieutenant Audie Murphy served in World War II, and you know there were reports from his ex-wife and many of his colleagues that he had a sense of restlessness, insecurity. He was fighting the war in his sleep. He kept a gun under his pillow and on occasions held them, thinking that they were the enemy, mm-hmm. at gunpoint. Mm-hmm. So that's not good. So all of the symptoms of PTSD. However, there was a strange demarcation between his personal life and the life that he still had as sort of a reservist in the Army after the war. And he won the Medal of Honor, so he was sort of given the title of hero, which he took very well. And even though he, you know, sort of developed this high perceived self-efficacy through his achievements, his personal life was very disturbed. But when he made military appearances for parades or he gave speeches and stuff like that to military officers to try and, you know, promote the idea of PTSD in combat veterans, because it was very unknown, well, not unknown, but it was very uncommon during that time, you know. PTSD, what is that? Combat stress, what is that? It was sort of unknown to society. So when he, you know, got up and gave speeches about combat veteran support and stuff like that, he was perfectly fine. But in his personal life, he was very, very afflicted, given by the accounts of his colleagues and his wife. Moving on to Vietnam War, PTSD was coined in the DSM, and I think I gave a statistic about 830,000 veterans after the Vietnam War developed PTSD. So now that the disease was coined as a psychological disorder, numbers rose. And also, there was I mentioned this in my paper, there was a shift in how combat soldiers were trained. In World War II, the training was, I'm going to say, less mentally intensive for reasons that I cannot really specify, in that soldiers trained during World War II were sort of not expected to... The aspect of their training was less oriented to killing and more oriented towards physical training and, you know, keeping up with the majority of the armed forces. Mm-hmm. Not so much. And that whole paradigm shifted in Vietnam War when it was, I term it, conditioned killing during basic training. And during the 20 to 30 years between the between World War II and the Vietnam War, that shifted. This conditioned training shifted. And basically, the Vietnam War veterans were trained to kill in their basic training. I give an example of a combat veteran who, during his basic training, was ordered by his drill sergeant to kill a kitten. And I know, right? And so he did so, but later that night, he accounted after many years that he wept that night uncontrollably. And however, during a combat situation in Vietnam, he was able to kill without remorse. So it is this break in the person's consciousness: was I ordered to kill someone, or did I do it? That's the break in identity. It's the attribution of responsibility, of killing, of doing whatever, that initiates this cascade, this mechanistic cascade. And, yeah, that's great. And then I go on saying this contradicted the person's identity because what previously formed his or her identity sort of got destroyed in this process of conditioned killing and just sort of conditioning oneself to taking orders. And there was this developed a confusion between a person's true identity and whether the person's identity was actually what they were, you know, mm-hmm. killers. So that was the break. And that was my whole spiel on the Vietnam War. also, the public did not support the war as it did during World War II, so there were obviously social ramifications on the development of PTSD. War on terrorism. So right now we are still fighting the war on terrorism. And I give two accounts, two personal accounts, actually. These were both people in the ROTC program here who I interviewed. I had the privilege to interview because one of them actually graduated the year before. I went into the program, and he served as a second lieutenant in an infantry corps in Afghanistan, and the second one was actually my cadre when I trained with the ROTC program here. And I'll give you my cadre's account because the other one's account is a little bit longer. And I know I'm past my time mark. So he is probably the most professional, my master sergeant, the most professional soldier that I have met in the ROTC program here. He's served in, South Korea, Gulf War, Bosnian War, Kosovo in 1999, Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom. And if you take a look at this guy's military dress uniform, it must be like 20 pounds because he has ribbons all over here. But anyway, in combat during the Gulf War and Operation Iraqi Freedom, he was hit with 8 IEDs. All of which were directed to his Humvee with a squad in it. So this is funny when he was telling me. But that wasn't the first time he experienced sort of combat stress. The first time he experienced combat stress was in the Gulf War when he took his first victim, if you will. He was a private first class, and he saw an Iraqi soldier and pulled the trigger. And he, at that time, was very in tune, and I got this impression from him when I interviewed him. He said, you know, if he didn't have a towel around his face, I probably would have let him go. It's a good thing I didn't see his ugly face. And he said, sure, I felt bad, but that's war. And there you can tell that he truly, you know, acknowledged his own professional being as a soldier. You know, this is what I have to do. This is a necessary evil. And I truly got that impression from him. However, when he entered Operation Iraqi Freedom, he was hit by 8 IEDs, and after the third, his platoon leader said, okay, you're not going out on any Humvees because you're just bad luck. And he, after that, was very, very stressed out, as he told me. And I got the same impression from my fellow cadets who said that he was just a mess. He was disoriented when we rehearsed, you know, drill and ceremony, and he was recently redeployed to, I think this time was Afghanistan, and he was not too happy about it. but he felt like, you know, something was frustrating him, something was wrong. And this can be explained by the low perceived self-efficacy that he saw when the IEDs hit him during the sort of surprise, if you will. I know that's a blatant euphemism. But during that, he sort of did not understand how he was unable to take control of the situation. Because before, during the Gulf War, I told you, he was a very, very professional soldier. He understood the situations that he was involved in. And he could make really quick and good decisions to save himself and his soldiers. But during the in the war on terrorism, you know, you have guerrilla warfare, you have IEDs, you have planted bombs that can go off at any minute, and you don't know whether, you know, it's safe to step anywhere. So there was sort of a shift in his perceived self-efficacy, which, you know, developed into the symptoms of PTSD. And ain't no me in the United States Army. And I'll just give this very briefly. I know I'm way over. I'm sure all of you have heard the news about Major Hassan, at the Fort Hood massacre. He was a military psychiatrist, and he was reported to be a confirmed Muslim. And it occurred to me that being confirmed Muslim and being part of the United States Army during this time is a wonderful time to be a gnomic. because you have, on the one hand, personal identity being afflicted by war. So if you think about it, you have a Muslim who was going to be deployed to the Middle East to help soldiers who were going to kill his own, people who had the same belief. And that, to me, is probably the most difficult situation that anybody can be in. And that I attribute to the sort of anomie and development of PTSD and how that can sort of develop into PTSD. And I go on and on and on and on and on about that. I do mention transference, but that was sort of as an aside. So transference is just the psycho phenomenon which the patient perceives the therapist as a person who made them think in such a way. I know that's a terrible example. Transference. An unconscious redirection of feelings from one person to another. That's better. Yeah, and then I just conclude. That's it.
Want to read us your conclusion?
If I have time.
Quickly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gee, quickly? all right, so the subject of combat stress and PTSD goes far beyond the scope of this paper, obviously. One must factor in other synergistic aspects of PTSD, such as physical environment of the war, and I highlight the Gulf War syndrome as one of those environments, soldiers breathing in oil fumes, stuff like that, that may contribute to certain physiological aspects of the disease. However, one must keep in mind that the victims of PTSD are not completely stoic machines, but rather human beings who have their own minds and their own personal morals and identities. In this presentation, I tried to show how the development of PTSD is specifically linked to an equilibrium and pathway, being one that originates in the disruption of one's personal identity. In personal identity, I mean the mind, collective consciousness. Not only that, but also I assert that the personal identity entails a forensic disposition, charging responsibility for one's actions and thoughts to a single individual. From a broken personal identity, combat veterans become disoriented, losing track of themselves and their situation, not realizing that they have long since exited the battlefield and entered civilian life. One must also not forget that the wars are fought for national ideals. World War II, Vietnam, and the current war in the Middle East, current wars in the Middle East, also all happen because of a necessity to protect our interests as a nation, whether it's defending it from an attack or preemptively striking for means of containment. It would be interesting to see the development of PTSD through a mechanism of nationalism. A lack of personal identity, as already stated in this paper, plays an extremely important role in the development of PTSD. However, the context of personal identity lies within the soldier's mind, this presentation, does not focus heavily on the collective mind of the society, nor how society creates this break in personal identity in the soldier, thus leading to PTSD. So I sort of give two openings for further development. In training, all senior cadets extol the need for younger cadets to show motivation, persistence, and pushing forward. They say that it's 90% mental and 10% physical. If this is the case, we must understand how far we should push our soldiers, whether in training or on duty, as the mind will be overworked. Upon reflection on writing this paper, I realize now that how a future in Army medicine might take into account the development and maintenance of the soldier's well-being and, probably even more important, the strength of the soldier's mind. In order to preserve the fighting strength of our servicemen and women, leaders of this nation must acknowledge that physical casualties are only the tip of a much larger, unseen, and quite frequently misunderstood iceberg of casualties, those pertaining to the minds of our soldiers.